Welcome to the Law Hour Editorial Review. Now, the Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally on KU Band Radio at Telstar 5, 7 days a week on Truth Radio Network, and in more than 70 countries worldwide on the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and the Editorial Review, please visit my website. That's georgegordon.org. Again, georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about the law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on Parthia, the forgotten ancient superpower, when we come back. In 1787, the writers of our Constitution put in this clause at Article 1, Section 10. It says, "No state shall make anything but gold or silver coin a tender in payment of debt." And that clause follows the biblical injunction on just weights and balances that we see in Leviticus 19, verses 35 and 36. Now, private business is carried on in gold and silver coin, but public business is conducted in commercial paper. Commercial paper like stocks, bonds, Federal Reserve notes, credit, debt, usury, credit cards. Well, back in 1965, Congress said that there wasn't any difference in the value of gold and silver coin versus clad coin or currency. And you know that's true when you're dealing with banks, government, and commercial industries. But out here in the real marketplace, there's a 7-to-1 difference in the purchasing power of gold over paper. And there's a 7-to-1 difference in the taxes that are due on that paper versus the gold coin. Now, God and our founding fathers did not give us gold and silver coin for no good purpose. They knew that as a matter of law, gold and silver coin was absolutely necessary for us to deal in order to establish our property rights. Well, neither did Congress and the politicians take our gold and silver coin away from us for no good reason either. They knew, and they knew full well back in 1933, that in order to subjugate a free people, they would first have to take their gold and silver coin away in order to take away the people's right to property and to destroy their property rights. So if you and I intend to regain our rights, duties, and capacities, then we must first regain our property and our property rights, because property is the legal foundation of all of our liberties. Now, if you'd like more information about private business and private business school, why don't you call and order my free general law CD package. That's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general. Remember, it's informative, it's entertaining, it's educational, and it's free of charge, and you can call right now to order yours. The number is 417-273-4967. And my business school is also available on compact disc for adult home study. If you're online, you can go to my website, georgegordon.org, click onto the email machine, and send an email request for the general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. We've been reviewing a book called Parthia, the Forgotten Ancient Superpower by Stephen Collins. You can get a copy of it from Bible Blessings, Box 1778, Royal Oak, Michigan, zip code 48068. The website is www.BibleBlessings.net. It's an easy one, www.BibleBlessings.net. Last time when we broke off, we were talking about a plague that went through the Roman Empire in the 2nd century A.D., This was the second, apparently, the divine plague against the Romans for having invaded Parthia. Now, whether you believe in divine retribution or not, the simple fact is that Parthia's empire was spared around the time of the Messiah, based upon a divine plague or a divine intervention, and then it happened a second time with this disease plague that went through the Roman Empire. And this plague was responsible for severely reducing the native Latin population. It also had a permanent effect on the character and the composition of both the Roman Empire and its army. In the centuries after this plague, the major die-off of Rome's Latin population resulted in a transformed Roman army. After this catastrophe, Roman armies were increasingly recruited from Gauls, Germans, and other subject populations who were willing to serve under Rome's imperial standards for pay, booty, or future Roman citizenship. Significantly, while this plague devastated the whole Roman Empire, there is no mention of this plague affecting Parthia at all. That this plague rescued Parthia and devastated their Roman invaders does support a belief that the plague was a severe divine judgment from God against Rome. The Romans, after two of their armies were expelled from Parthia by divine action, developed a brief and a belief that the previous return of Parthian territory by the Emperor Hadrian sprang more from prudence than from generosity. While modern man may scoff at the thought of divine intervention in the affairs of nations, the ancient Romans accepted a divine origin for the terrible natural disasters and plagues that had driven them from Parthia. One such occurrence could be a random event, but two such occurrences in a row argued against any coincidence. Decades later, another major Roman-Parthian war was fought in approximately 200 AD, in which Mesopotamian natives massacred Roman garrisons, aided by Parthian vassal kings. This led to a Roman-Parthian war, when Severus, Rome's emperor, led an army across the Euphrates River. Diverted by internal problems, Severus returned to Rome. The Parthians attacked, routed the Roman armies, besieged Nisibis, a Roman headquarters, and crossed the Euphrates River into Roman territory. Severus returned to the Middle East and fought his way to Ctesiphon, that's C-T-E-S-I-P-H-O-N, Ctesiphon, Parthia's western capital on the Tigris River. The Roman army captured Ctesiphon and perpetrated an orgy of violence, killing Parthian males and making slaves of about 100,000 women and children. The Romans withdrew, but this time retained control of much of Mesopotamia. Parthia seemed inert, indicating a state of crisis within Parthia. Furthermore, if the previous defeats of Roman armies under Trajan and Cassius were the result of divine action, the lack of divine assistance in repulsing this Roman attack speaks volumes. Since God's assistance is dependent on obedience to God's laws, the lack of any help from nature indicated that Parthia was in a state of internal decline and or rebellion against God. This brings us to the last Roman-Parthian War. The final Roman-Parthian War began with immense treachery on the part of the Romans. In 215 AD, the emperor Caracallus launched a disinformation campaign to dupe the Parthians into letting down their defenses. He masqueraded as a peacemaker and even offered to marry a daughter of the Parthian monarch. The deceitful Romans even proposed a political and economic union between Parthia and Rome. Even though Rome had a long record of breaking its promises and treaties, just like the Russians have in the 20th century, the Parthians believed Rome's phony peace initiative, just like Americans have swallowed the communist peace initiative, hook, line, and sinker, and they allowed the Roman emperor, escorted by a huge army, to proceed to the Parthian capital for the wedding. It's a testimony to the human capacity for self-delusion that the gullible Parthians were so willing to trust Rome in spite of the fact that every historical precedent warned that such an offer could not be genuine. They continued in a state of denial even as Caracallus marched his army to Ctesiphon, Parthia's western capital, and Parthia so wanted to believe that Caracallus was a reformer, an enlightened man of peace, different from the warlike Romans of the past. The Parthians received the Romans with genuine hospitality, certain that the New World Order, to borrow a modern phrase, a universal peace and harmony was just about to begin. Little editorial comment here, you know, we have the same thing going on in the world today. Communism has been defeated, hasn't it? I mean, it's a done deal. And Gorbachev struck a deal and tore down the Berlin Wall. He has his headquarters in San Francisco, California, to this day. America, like our progenitors in Parthia, is about to be double-crossed and destroyed, just like Parthia was double-crossed and destroyed. And America today, like Parthia of old, turned against God. We refuse to obey God's laws today, and inevitably, there's a day of reckoning coming. You give God the finger long enough, and pretty soon, he's going to kick ass. So even though Rome had a strong and a long record of breaking its promises and treaties, the Parthians believed Rome's phony peace initiative, just like we believe in the communist phony peace initiative. China, a trading partner. Russia, a democracy. Well, according to a classical author, Herodian, the Parthians were transported with joy at the prospect of an eternal peace and were keeping holiday. As Caracallus and his army arrived, finally the Romans dropped their pretense of peace and began slaughtering the gullible Parthians. The Parthian monarch barely escaped with his life. Not content with his already heinous betrayal of Parthian trust, the Romans then added massive insult to massive injury by desecrating the Parthian royal cemetery at Arbela, the same area where Alexander the Great had defeated Darius of Persia in the Battle of Gaugamela. The Romans scattered the remains of the deceased Parthian kings. The Romans were desecrating the grapes of the progeny of King David of ancient Israel, the progenitor of the dynastic line of Phares, P-H-A-R-E-S, which ruled Parthia. The Romans would come to deeply regret this needless act of sacrilege against the deceased Parthian kings because that single act mobilized the entire Parthian Empire against Rome. Outraged now beyond words, the Parthians assembled a vast military force to take vengeance on the Romans. Based on accounts and subsequent events, it may have been the largest army, army that Parthia ever assembled against Rome. And while Rome's armies had invaded the westernmost provinces of Parthia's empire, those provinces were inhabited by native populations subject to the Parthians. Rome's armies had never penetrated or even threatened the Parthian homelands near the Caspian Sea, since Parthia's central, northern, and eastern provinces had never been bothered by Roman invasions. Parthians in those undisturbed areas may have been growing increasingly resistant about furnishing soldiers to imperiled vassal kings in Parthia's western provinces. Ctesiphon, the Parthian capital, spelled C-T-E-S-I-P-H-O-N, I'm assuming that's Ctesiphon, known to the Romans, was nowhere near the actual homeland of the Parthians. And it's possible that Ctesiphon was an administrative center for governing Parthia's western provinces, and that other regional capitals existed elsewhere in Parthia's empire. Rawlinson's book, Intercourse Between India and the Western World, has a different perspective on the capitals of Parthia's empire. He wrote that Ctesiphon was only the winter capital of Parthia, and he also wrote the following about the role of the Parthian cities of Ctesiphon and Hecatompylus, I guess it's Hecatompylus, in the great overland silk routes across Parthia, which connected China and India with the Mediterranean world. Great cities sprang up, he said, created by this traffic. And one of the chief roads, the one which ran from Parthian capital at Hecatompylus, passed through Ecbatana and Ctesiphon, I guess it is. At Ctesiphon, it branched off in several directions. Now, the main track running across Mesopotamia and ending at Antioch. Now, another important branch of this road ran to Palmyra and then to Damascus, Gaza, Tyre, and Sidon, and joined the network of highways which converged to Petra. Well, H.G. Rawlinson favors the use of the consonant K instead of a C in his place names. However, he asserts that the city of Hecatompylus was actually the true capital of the entire Parthian Empire. Hecatompylus was a city located in the heartland of Parthia near the southern coast of the Caspian Sea. No Roman army had ever gotten anywhere near Hecatompylus or the Parthian homeland in which it was located. Now, Ctesiphon was apparently an important western administrative center due to its location at which the trade routes of the Great Silk Road came together. Ctesiphon perhaps hosted the Parthian emperor and his court during the winter, when they moved south to avoid the harsher winters in Parthia's homeland to the north. So the Romans would have regarded Ctesiphon as Parthia's capital, as it was the only Parthian city with which they associated the Parthian emperor and his court. Well, no matter how remote they were from the site of Rome's sacrilege, all Parthians throughout the empire were outraged by the violations of the tombs and the corpses of their dead emperors. That was an offense that they could all fight to avenge. I guess it's kind of like knocking down the trade towers or attacking Pearl Harbor. So the Scythian nature of the Parthians is well documented, and the Scythian reverence for the dead was a long-known historic fact. When Darius of Persia attacked the Scythians many centuries earlier near the Black Sea, he was warned that Scythia's retribution would be most dire if he desecrated any Scythian cemeteries. So given the historic relationship between Parthia and their Scythian kinsmen, it is possible that Scythian tribes furnished troops for this climatic battle against Rome. And in the words of George Rawlinson, he said the passions of the Parthians had been roused. Artabanus was determined to exact a heavy retribution for the treacherous massacre of Ctesiphon and the wanton impiety of Arbela. So the Parthian army was assembled over the winter months, as it took considerable time to gather Parthia's enormous resources into one massive military command. Parthian troops could have come from as far away as Saka kingdoms in India. Rome also had time to reinforce its army with additional troops from throughout its empire. Roman sources record that the Romans even brought in a powerful body of Mauritanian cavalry from Western Africa. The tension throughout the Roman and Parthian empires must have rose to a fever pitch, as everyone knew that the two mightiest empires on earth were gathering their strengths for a last titanic struggle. Because Rome and Parthia were both reinforcing their armies by drawing in additional forces from their respective vassal states throughout the Mediterranean and Asian worlds, the impending conflict was going to be an ancient world war. The Roman headquarters in the area was at Nisibis, near the modern border of Syria and Turkey today. The enraged Parthian army headed for Nisibis, thirsting for revenge. The Romans assassinated Caracallus, and the new Roman emperor, Macrinus, tried to appease the Parthians by offering to return Parthian captives as part of a peace treaty. The Parthian emperor, Artabanus IV, spurned the offer as the Parthians were coming toward the Romans to exact vengeance and spill as much Roman blood as possible. Nothing could have deterred the bloodletting that was about to occur. Artabanus IV, the emperor of Parthia, personally led the Parthian army. Macrinus, the emperor of Rome, personally led the Roman army. And these two great armies clashed in what must have been one of the fiercest and bloodiest battles ever fought anywhere in the ancient world. Indeed, because nations from Western Africa to India were contributing forces to the two clashing armies. This may have been the greatest battle ever fought in the ancient world. What occurred in 217 AD was not merely a battle, but the death struggle of two huge, powerful, and well-established empires. Citing the classical Roman writers, Rawlinson states, quote, "The Battle of Nisibis, which terminated the long contest between Rome and Parthia, was the fiercest and best contested which was ever fought between the two rival powers. It lasted 3 days. The army of Artabanus was numerous and well-appointed. Like almost every Parthian force, it was strong in cavalry and archers. And it had a novel addition of soldiers clad in complete armor and carrying long spears or lances who were mounted on camels. The Romans suffered greatly from the bows of the horse archers and from the lances of the corps mounted on camels. And as they retired, they strewed the ground with spiked balls and other contrivances for injuring the feet of animals. This kind of fighting went on for 3 full days. The armor-clad Parthians must have looked like medieval knights mounted on camels as they charged the Romans with leveled lances. The Romans were ingenious in countering these assaults by devising methods to maim the feet of the Parthian mounts. The killing was awesome. The Roman historian Herodian recorded that the heaps of dead were piled to such a height that the maneuvers of the troops were impeded by them, and at last the two contending hosts could scarcely see one another. At the point of mutual exhaustion, the battle ended with a decisive Parthian victory. Macrinus, the Roman emperor, fled the scene and afterward agreed to repatriate all Parthian captives and pay a large war indemnity to Parthia. In his book, Persia, published in 1888, historian S. G. W. Benjamin writes of this great event, quote, Macrinus, the Roman emperor, suffered two crushing defeats from Artabanus and was obliged to pay an indemnity of 50 million denarii to a great rival of Rome almost in the very hour when the doom of Parthia was sounded on the great bell of time. The hero, Artabanus IV of Parthia, who wrested a war indemnity from a Roman emperor, was also the last. He was the last Parthian emperor. Is there any event more dramatic in the record of nations? Given the significance of this great struggle at Nisibis, why has this titanic battle of two ancient superpowers been virtually censored out of our history textbooks? What is it about Parthia that causes its history to be ignored, even though it was one of the world's largest and most powerful empires, with one of the world's largest and most powerful armies? Would any modern historian even realize that an event involving Parthia could be one of the most dramatic events in the record of the nations? The classical Greco-Roman historians wrote copiously about Scythian and Parthian history. As recently as the late 19th century, historians such as George Rawlinson and S.G.W. Benjamin could still recognize the immense battle at Nisibis between Rome and Parthia as one of the greatest events of world history. Yet today, the important histories of Scythia and Parthia have been virtually erased from history texts. Why does this glaring omission exist? Is it only a coincidence that history looks generally de-emphasized, or books generally de-emphasize or omit the histories of the great empires founded by the 10 tribes of Israel, Phoenicia, Carthage, Scythia, and Parthia, while waxing eloquent about the histories of the non-Israelite empires? In the late 19th and 20th centuries, the dogma of evolution became the new religion of a secularized world. It is now politically incorrect for academia to publicize anything which verifies the Bible or supports a belief in the God of Israel. Those in secular academia must now bow down to the new intellectual idol of evolution if they want to safeguard their educational careers. So it hardly seems coincidental that the world's awareness of the empires of the 10 tribes of Israel dramatically declined when evolution became the new god of modern academia. Because the historical truths of Phoenicia, Carthage, Scythia, and Parthia, if told, would greatly affirm biblical accounts and verify that the God of the Bible really does guide and direct world events. And adherents of evolution have held back the truth about world history. So this series of books on Israelite history is an effort to restore a balanced perspective on world history by restoring the Israelite empires to the prominence given them by classical Greco-Roman writers and from historians who predated Darwinism and evolutionary philosophy. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. You know, under the terms of a contract called the Old Covenant, which was negotiated by Moses out at Mount Sinai, you and I are entitled to 33 articulable benefits such as rain in due season and multiplied gold, silver, herds, flocks, and great wealth. Well, both George Bush Sr. back in 1992 and George Bush Jr. in 2000 said that what Americans wanted, though, was jobs, jobs, jobs. But you know, that's not what George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Ben Franklin, Moses, or God had in mind when they wrote our Constitution, our Bill of Rights, and the Ten Commandments. And that's because all of these authorities recognize that real wealth is measured in land. It's measured in cattle. It's measured in property, gold, silver, wheat, corn, beans, onion, oil. It's not measured in employment. It's not measured in jobs, jobs, jobs. And that's because there's no money in employment. The money is in private business. The money is in sales. There's no money in public business, and there's certainly no money in jobs, jobs, jobs. That's why I contend that it's time that you cashed in on your inheritance and learned how to collect the benefits of this old covenant contract and to collect those benefits in gold, silver, wheat, corn, beans, honey, and oil. That's real property instead of credit, debt, usury, inflation, and worthless paper. Now, if you want to learn more about how to do just that, why don't you call for more information on my CD Home School for Adults and order my free general law CD package at the same time. Now, that free CD package is a four-hour commentary on the law in general. It's informative, it's entertaining, it's educational, it's free. Remember, it's free of charge. You can call right now to order yours. The number is 417-273-4967. And if you're online, go to the website, georgegordon.org. Click onto the email machine, send me an email request for that free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct, the number 417-273-4967. Well, this brings us up to the fall of Parthia. We Israelites have been practicing Anglo-Saxon administration since Moses gave it to us at Mount Sinai about 3,100 years ago. Unfortunately, we have a checkered history. We obey God and keep His commandments, become wealthy, powerful, and great, and then we turn against our God when we become wealthy, powerful, and great, giving the finger, and He tunes us up in like manner. So our Israelite history has been obscured. It's obscured from time to time because we go into national captivity, and our captors, whether it be the Romans or whether it be some other empire, such as the Egyptians, Assyrians, Babylonians, Greeks, Romans, they take us into captivity, and then they erase our history. Because remember, history is written by the victors. We saw that in our Civil War. The North, the Yankees write the history for the South, the Confederates in Georgia. Well, at Nisibis, the Parthian Empire achieved perhaps its greatest victory over the Roman Empire. However, the triumph was the last Parthian military success. The end of its empire was now at hand. And it's recorded that Artabanus IV, Parthia's emperor, sought to the occult for guidance and was told Parthia's empire was about to end. This account eerily echoes that of King Saul, the first Israelite king whose efforts to seek occult guidance led to his own defeat and his own death. Now, based on the biblical precedent, it is a symptom of terminal moral decay when a society's leaders seek to occult mediums, channelers, for guidance, witchcraft. Being a great idolatry, such actions not only forfeit God's favor, but also invite His direct punishment. If God had indeed divinely favored and protected Parthia in earlier decades, this sin of Artabanus was especially grievous. And even though Parthia had won a supreme victory over Rome, it collapsed soon after its emperors had a seance. In 220 AD, the province of Persia revolted. A series of three battles was fought, which resulted in a Persian victory in 227 AD. That cost Artabanus IV his life and effectively ended the Parthian Empire. The Sasanian Persian Empire replaced the Parthian Empire, and the Parthians were forced to migrate out of their old empire to flee the Persians. Many histories discuss Parthian history as a part of Persian history, but this is very misleading. And although the Parthians ruled the territory of the former Persian Empire, the Parthians and the Persians were separate and distinct people living in the same region of the world. The Parthians had been the subjects of the Persians during the reigns of Cyrus and Darius, centuries previous to this time. For 500 years, the Parthians ruled an empire in which the Persians were a subject nation. But in 220 AD, the Persians threw off part of the Parthian rule and drove the Parthians out of the region. Where the Parthians went and the new names by which they came to be known will be discussed in Book 4 of this series on Israelite history. When one of the greatest empires in the world collapses and its millions of people migrate elsewhere, it causes severe dislocations for many nations and regions of the earth. The migrations and dislocations of nations which followed the collapse of Parthia has been well documented in secular history. And these accounts will be examined in the following book, which will trace the Israelites' descendants into the modern world. And while the migrations and national dislocations which followed the collapse of the vast Parthian Empire have been amply discussed and documented in secular histories of the world, those same secular histories and historians have never realized or acknowledged that it was the collapse of Parthia, the great Asian Empire, which caused the great migrations and national dislocations which began in the 3rd century AD. Now, this examination of Parthia's history has so far been dominated by events in its western provinces that bordered the Roman Empire. This is unavoidable since classical Greek and Roman writers and writings are the basis for much of what we know about Parthia today. Naturally, these ancient writers wrote about the events that occurred in the western areas of Parthia where Roman Parthia's spheres of influence overlap. The wars and events detailed so far took place within the territories of modern Syria, Israel, Turkey, and Iraq. Parthia's empire also included modern Iran, Afghanistan, part of Pakistan, and the southern regions of the former Soviet Union, and into India. No Roman army ever threatened these regions of Parthia, and less is known about their history. Besides Parthia, portions of the 10 tribes of Israel also ruled Sakha kingdoms to the east of Parthia in the region of modern Pakistan and India. Various Sakha or Sakhi kings began ruling in Pakistan and northwest India during the 1st century BC. There were also Pallava or Indo-Parthian rulers in that region who had names like the Parthian Arsacids. Among these rulers was Gandapheres, who exhibited the name of the Davidic royal line Pheres of the Kingdom of Judah. And the Encyclopedia Britannica states that the name Pahlavi, that's P-A-H-L-A-V-I, Pahlavi, I guess, or Lavi, Pahlavi, means Parthian, and adds that the great commercial town of Minagar in the Indus Delta was under Parthian kings. The Sakha kingdoms bore the name of Isaac, and their kings had Parthian names. We know very little about the extent to which the Parthian emperors and the Sakha kings either cooperated or competed. Richard Fry writes the following concerning Parthian Sakha affairs. He said, Indian sources imply that the Sakhas and the Pallavas, Parthians, were allies in their Indian conquests, and this would seem to be corroborated by the coins with both Sakha and Parthian names. The adoption of the title King of Kings by Gondopheres would imply that these Indo-Parthian kings were completely independent of any other Parthian rulers. Now, this title, King of Kings, was the standard title of Parthian emperors, and the Indo-Parthian use of the name and the same term confirms their affinity with Parthia, even if they constituted separate kingdoms. While very little is known of Parthia's eastern affairs, we do know that Parthian dominance and or influence extended into modern India, and when the Parthian Empire collapsed, some of the Saka and Indo-Parthian kingdoms on the eastern border continued to exist. Now, how far did Parthian contacts and influence extend to the east? Shahab Satuda Nijad, writing in the Asian Culture Quarterly, noted the following, quote, "History of contacts between the Persian world and the Far East dates from the reign of Mithridates II in 123 BC to 87 BC, when in 115 BC this monarch of the Parthian dynasty received an envoy from the emperor of China. Well, by the 3rd century AD, the Parthian Empire's trade routes were extended in the maritime ports of Southeast Asia as far as the Malay Peninsula's international port of Tun Sun, where the merchants had established settlements with no less than 500 residents. Their activities intended to the Indo-Chinese port of Tonkin, and as such, accounts on the sea trade activities of the Parthians were recorded by Kang Tai, Wu Dynasty envoy to the kingdom of Funan in the delta of the Mekong in the first period of the 3rd century of the Christian era." Now, the above is a remarkable account that Parthian trade and influence extended far eastward into Asia. Southeast Asia was so far from the Roman Empire that its writers knew little or nothing about Parthia's activities in that region. The above account indicates that Parthian contacts with China began early during the expansionary phase of the Parthian Empire, and it also indicates Parthia's trade with the Far East Asia was extensive, requiring settlements of up to 500 Parthians in various Asian ports to handle the trading volume. The account that Parthian merchants were recorded in the Mekong Delta region, which is now in modern Vietnam in the 3rd century AD, shows how far Parthian influence had spread by the time that its empire collapsed. Parthia was strategically located in the middle of the famous Silk Road, running from China across Asia to the Mediterranean and Roman world. No doubt Parthia's government and its merchants used this fact to their advantage, charging transit fees for permission to ship Asian goods westward and Roman goods eastward across Parthian territory. So during this peaceful period between Parthia and Rome, from the 1st century BC until later in the 1st century AD, this traffic would have been very extensive. And a book by H.G. Rawlinson had the following description of the ancient Silk Road from Asia to the Mediterranean region. He said, quote, "Silk was destined to become an immensely important article of commerce. The expeditions of the Bactrian monarchs had opened out the great trade route which runs from Balk to the historic stone tower of Sarakel. Some of the silk also found its way through Nepal to the Ganges and thence to Malabar coast, and later on it was taken straight from China to Rome by the land route from Sarakal to Balk, and a number of other names I can't even pronounce, and then by sea to Petra, Tyre, and Levant." Well, H.G. Rawlinson's quote favors the use of the consonant K instead of the C used by most other writers for these place names, using the more common C, Hecatompylus, Ectatena, and Ctesiphon were all major cities in the Parthian Empire. Obviously, when Parthia and Rome were at war, nothing traveled to or from Rome across this Silk Route. However, when Rome and Parthia had peaceful relations, Roman customers were eager for the goods of the Far East transported across Parthia's vast empire. The later period of the Parthian Empire witnessed frequent wars with Rome, which disrupted trade between Rome and China. In order to satisfy Roman demand for silk, Roman merchants initiated maritime traffic to Asia in 166 AD, circumventing the Parthian-controlled Silk Route. Now, the article from the Asian Culture Quarterly also recorded that China was concerned not only about Parthia's ability to block its trade Roman customers by way of the Silk Route, but also Parthia's growing merchant fleets in Asian waters. China had been prevented by Parthia to receive envoys from Byzantium through Persian territory and was also denied direct access to the Mediterranean trade on geopolitical considerations. And as such, the Chinese, in pursuit of an alternative trade route away from the Central Asian overland routes under Parthian control, were keeping an eye on Parthia's trade expansion on the maritime routes of Southeast Asia. And because Roman accounts about Parthia involved their relationships across the Eurasian landmass, Rome had never directly witnessed Parthian naval capabilities. Parthian maritime skills would have been irrelevant in the wars fought with Rome on the Western Front the periphery of its empire. However, Parthian trade with ancient ports in Southeast Asia and the Malay Peninsula with Vietnam required maritime skills. And again, we're indebted to the article by Shahab Sutta Nijab for the following information. He said, quote, around this time when Parthia traded with Southeast Asia, a technological innovation in the shipbuilding industry of the Persian Gulf resulted in the construction of vessels with a rig that accommodated the ships to sail nearer the wind. The knowledge of this innovative development spread along the shores of the Indian Ocean and further east at a time when the Sasanian dynasty replaced the Parthians in Persia. Now, Persian ships with up to 7 sails, carrying as many as 700 seamen and 1,000 metric tons of cargo, were plying the Indian Ocean in the direction of the sea routes further east to India. And at the time these maritime innovations developed, the Persian Gulf was dominated by Parthia, and it's logical that Parthian ingenuity was the source of the maritime advances that facilitated trade between Parthia and the Far East. And there's often some overlap in historical accounts involving the late Parthian and early Sasanian period, that's S-A-S-S-A-N-I-A-N, period in Persia. However, since it was Parthia which pioneered and expanded this maritime trade through its trade routes between the Persian Gulf and the Far East, it is likely that it was Parthian skill which led to these developments and the Sasanian Persian Empire, which supplanted the Parthian Empire, would surely have also taken over the Parthian Sea commerce with Asia and expanded it even further. You're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review. You know, Joe Smith started the day early, having set his alarm clock made in Japan for 6 a.m. While his coffee pot made in Japan is perking, he puts his blow dryer made in Taiwan to work and then shaves with his electric razor made in Hong Kong. Joe then puts on a dress shirt made in Taiwan. He puts on his designer jeans made in Singapore and a pair of tennis shoes made in Korea. Then after cooking up some breakfast in his new electric skillet, which is made in the Philippines, he sits down to figure out on his calculator, which is made in Mexico, just how much can he spend today. Then after setting his watch made in Switzerland to the radio made in Hong Kong, he goes out and gets in his car made in Germany, goes looking for a job, like he has for many months. He wants one of those good-paying American jobs. Then after the end of another discouraging and fruitless day, Joe decides to relax for a while, so he puts on a pair of sandals made in Brazil, and pours himself a glass of wine made in France, turns on the TV made in Japan, and then ponders again why it is that he can't find a good-paying American job. Well, I would say to Joe, instead of a good-paying American job, why don't you look for a good-paying American private business dealing in property instead of income? Now, if you'd like to go out and tap into this power of private business, why don't you call and order my free general law CD package, and let me show you how to do that. It's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general. It's informative, it's entertaining, and it's free of charge, and it's educational. You can call right now. The number to call, 417-273-4967. If you're online, go to the website, georgegordon.org. Click onto the email machine, and then send an email request for that special CD package. That's the general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about the ancient Parthian Empire, Parthia and Scythia, two Israelite empires made up of the lost 10 tribes of the House of Israel. By the way, Collins has a book called The Lost 10 Tribes of Israel Found. So that's a fascinating book. If you want to see where we have settled out in the United States and Great Britain, France, Switzerland, and Germany, and Denmark, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, you know, we Americans are just a part of this ancient civilization called the Lost 10 Tribes of Israel. Those 10 tribes of Israel have become as numerous as the sand of the sea. We are the most dominant race of people on planet Earth today. And while we don't comprise most of the population, if you take a look at the influence of the Western European countries, Norway, Finland, Sweden, Denmark, Ireland, Scotland, England, Belgium, Luxembourg, France, Holland, Germany, Switzerland, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, you take a look at our economic power, our military power, our prominence in the world, and then ask yourself, the lost 10 tribes of Israel, could they be found? Collins has found them. I'm taking a look at his third book here. It's called Parthia, the Forgotten Ancient Superpower and Its Role in Biblical History. I rated a 1 in 100 read, and you'll go a long ways before you find another book as powerful as this. And it's not a religious book. In case you thought that this is some kind of religious diatribe and somebody's trying to get you to join the Pentecostal church, it's not. It's a historical book based upon Bible prophecy and biblical history. And you can get a copy from Bible Blessings. It's www.BibleBlessings.net. That's the webpage. Or you can write direct to Bible Blessings, Box 1778, Royal Oak, Michigan, 48068. Again, that's Royal Oak, Michigan, 48068, Box 1778. Now let's consider the maritime technology that permitted the construction of ships with 7 sails, and crewed by 700 sailors. Listen, boys and girls, in the 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries, when France, Spain, and Great Britain were at the peak of their maritime powers, when the Spanish galleons were plying the Atlantic and capturing booty from the New World and hauling it back, and while their ships were being engaged by buccaneers and pirated, you know how big the crews of those ships were? 50 men. We're talking about ships with 700 sailors, ships that were big enough to carry seven sails. There's only one ship built in around 1890 that had seven masts. Only one in modern times. Think of this. Seven sails, 700 sailors. Given its huge complement of sailors, the phrase seven sail likely means these immense trade ships had seven masts. The Parthian merchant vessels had been sailing to East Asian ports for approximately 300 years by the time its empire collapsed. The Sasanians, eager to enrich their own coffers by way of trade with the Far East, surely would have assumed control of the Parthian trading vessels in maritime context. Now contrast these Parthian leviathans with the relatively minuscule ships which Columbus sailed across the Atlantic in 1492 when he set out to rediscover America. It's a token of how far advanced was the culture of ancient Parthia that its sailing ships were vastly larger than the small sailing ships of medieval Europe in the 15th century when Europe was still emerging from the Dark Ages. Now Parthian culture and science comes into play. And as we've already seen, the Parthians placed Semitic legends on their coins during the early Christian era. However, there is additional evidence that the Parthians had always spoken the Semitic language. Josephus observed that he originally wrote his Wars of the Jews in his native Semitic language so that the people of Parthia would understand the events of the Roman-Jewish War of the first century AD. And Josephus wrote, quote, "I have proposed for the sake of such as live under the government of the Romans to translate those books into the Greek tongue, which I formerly composed in the language of our own country and sent to the upper barbarians, identified as the Parthians, Babylonians, Arabians, and the Jews beyond the Euphrates." Unquote. Josephus, before writing his works in Greek for a Roman audience, had already written Wars of the Jews in his own Semitic language, so the Parthians and the people in their empire could read them. Now, I want you to note that Josephus again uses the phrase beyond Euphrates to designate Parthian territory. When he wrote to the Romans, he was mindful of his Roman audience in calling the Parthians upper barbarians. Rawlinson states the following about Josephus's comments. He said, Josephus regarded the Parthians as familiar with Hebrew or Syro-Chaldaic, and he wrote his history of the Jewish war in his own native tongue for the benefit, especially, of the Parthians among whom he declares that he had many readers. Well, here's the smoking gun, boys and girls. Here's that smoking gun piece of evidence about Parthian origins. The Parthians were known to be so familiar with the Hebrew language that they could read whatever Josephus wrote, and he wrote it in his native tongue. The obvious conclusion is that the Jews and Parthians shared a common origin and language. The common elements in the Parthian and Hebrew languages further supports the conclusion that the Parthians were the descendants of the 10 tribes of Israel, combining the Parthian-Hebrew linguistic ties with Josephus and his own testimony, that the 10 tribes had an immense population and lived in Parthia, beyond the Euphrates. And it results in a clear positive identification. The Parthians were the descendants of the 10 tribes of Israel. Now, why would the Parthians have a particular interest in the writings of Josephus, and why would Josephus have a special interest in communicating information to them? Well, the clear answer is that both the Parthians and Josephus realized that the Parthians were the descendants of the 10 tribes of Israel. Nothing else makes sense. And Josephus was a product of the same Jewish culture that shaped the converts of the early New Testament church in Judea. That culture regarded non-Israelites as unclean people with whom Jews could not interact. You read that in Acts 10, verse 28. Now, Josephus was himself a Pharisee, just like the Apostle Paul, and he would have shared these same anti-Gentile views and would not have regarded the Parthians as worthy of extensive communication efforts on his part unless he realized that the Parthians were fellow Israelites of the 10 tribes of Israel. Josephus even records that during the Jewish revolt against Rome, which culminated in the destruction of the temple in 70 AD, that the Jews had hoped that the people beyond the Euphrates, the Parthians, would have joined their war with Rome. That the Jews looked to Parthia for allies against Rome adds even more weight to the conclusion that many Jews knew the Parthians were their related kinsmen of the 10 tribes of Israel. The Parthians utilized coordinated lunar and solar calendars. Dr. G.R. Asser of Edinburgh, Scotland, wrote the following observation about Parthian calendars. He said the Parthians operated two different but synchronized calendars. The first month of the lunar calendar was March-April. They had seven intercalary months in each 19-year period. The Parthian lunar calendar began in the spring, and its first month was named Nisanu, a Babylonian term. The ancient Hebrews also began their lunar calendar in the spring, and it was originally called Abib. Compare Exodus 13, verses 4 through 7, and Leviticus 23, verses 4 through 6. After the fall of Jerusalem, the Jews also adopted the name Nisan for the first month of the year. Nehemiah 2 verse 1 and Esther 3 verse 7 confirm this. Parthia's observation of a lunar calendar beginning in the spring would have been consistent with the culture of Israel from the time of the Exodus. The similarity of names for the first month, Nisan and Nisanu, and the use of seven intercalary months in a 19-year time cycle further confirms that the Parthians were the descendants of the 10 tribes of Israel and were still using the Hebrew calendar calculations even though they had relocated into Asia. Parthia maintained extensive trade relations with the Scythians and other people on their northern and eastern borders, as indicated by the presence of the Parthian coins being found on the Volga River, in the Caucasus Mountains, in Chinese Turkestan and elsewhere. At the same time, Parthian-Chinese contacts overland are attested in Chinese sources. And ancient Chinese sources offer insightful observations about the Parthians, and they provide a valuable perspective which supplements the Roman accounts about the Parthians. One account from approximately 91 BC states that when the first embassy was sent from China to Anzi Arsac, Parthia, the king of Parthia, ordered 20,000 cavalry to meet them on the eastern frontier. The wagons and ships of their merchants go to the neighboring countries. So we have testimony from Rome, Greece, the southern Russian Empire, the Volga River, coins dug up, Chinese sources. You know, as we look into ancient history, as we actually look at it, we can actually today in the 21st century uncover the truth about the ancient, alleged, so-called, lost 10 tribes of Israel. Well, I'm about out of time, so we'll have to leave it right there. We'll come back and we'll take up the China connection when we return next time. You've been listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week on Truth Radio Network and worldwide on the Internet. For more information about the Gordon Law School and the Law Hour, just go to my website. That's georgegordon.org. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to the homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school. And the Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, just call the Law School at 417-273-4967. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Well, we're just about out of time, and there's the signal that says that our time is up. So I got to leave it right there. We'll pick it up right here with the China Connection next time. I'll see you back here tomorrow, God willing. Same time, same station. So until then, good night, friends.